Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is the author of the book, which will be the subject of this year's Tulsa Reads. Bill Bryson is the best-selling author of 17 books on travel and history. His most recent book, One Summer, America 1927, is the Tulsa Reads book and looks at the momentous events of that summer. Charles Lindbergh's crossing the Atlantic in the spirit of St. Louis. Babe Ruth hitting 60 home runs as a part of the Murderers' Row, the great 1927 New York Yankees. But along the way at telling those stories, he tells nearly 25 other intriguing stories about America in 1927. From the rise of the anarchists to the Great Mississippi Flood to Al Jolson's The Jazz Singer, the first talkie motion picture, and Henry Ford's rebooting of his motor company with the Model A and his abortive attempt to create a model town near a Brazilian rubber plantation known as Fordlandia. It's fascinating stories. Bryson is the author of Notes from a Small Island, In a Sunburned Country, A Walk in the Woods, and At Home, A Short History of Private Life. He was born in America, grew up here, but spent most of his life in the UK. He'll be making two major appearances as a part of Tulsa Read, Friday for Tulsa Town Hall, which is available by subscription only, and he'll be speaking for the Oklahoma Center for Poets and Writers Thursday evening, November 13th. Bill Bryson is my guest today. Bill Bryson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on. I began reading your books with Notes from a Small Island back in the 1990s. Travel has been a big part of your writing over the years. And, of course, your travel writing was always about telling history and telling stories about places. And this book is no different, although you've kind of taken a different approach, I think, in the last couple of books, One Summer America, 1927. You're writing about a geographical time and place, and you're writing about popular history and culture.
It's quite a departure for me from this kind of book. I'd never done anything quite like this before, and I honestly didn't know exactly what I was getting into when I started doing it. My starting point was that I had always been strangely fascinated by the idea that Babe Ruth hit 60 home runs in the summer of 1927, which obviously a huge event for anybody who is interested in baseball. But at the very same time, exactly parallel with that, Charles Lindbergh flew the Atlantic. And so for a while I had it in mind that I would try and do a kind of dual biography of these two remarkable, iconic American figures, but with the idea that the narrative arc of the story would meet in the summer of 1927, where they both had their career years. And then what I found when I started doing more research for the book was that they were only really a small part of all the other things that happened in this one summer. You also had, you know, the filming of The Jazz Singer, the first talking picture, which obviously transformed popular entertainment globally. You had the Great Mississippi Flood. You had some incredible storms all over the United States. There were some of the worst tornadoes ever in Missouri, right down to Texas and through your part of the world. And just lots and lots of things like that were happening all over the place. Central bankers, the former central bankers for the world, took the kind of foolish decision that certainly led to the Great Depression, and lots of other things that were all happening all simultaneously this one summer. So the book became not just about Babe Ruth and Charles Lindbergh, although they are at the heart of the book. The book became about the summer itself, this period of 5 months when I don't think any nation has had more extraordinary things happen in such a short period ever.
This is one of the things I was thinking about as I was reading the book was 1927 that extraordinary year, or if you actually think of most years, are there extraordinary events that happen every year? And you've just written really wonderfully about the events of 1927.
No, I really do genuinely think. I mean, I took some care in the book not to try and overinflate the importance of this year. I mean, a lot of it was, you know, it didn't actually change the world. The fact that Babe Ruth hit 60 home runs didn't, you know, nobody lived longer or had a happier life because of that. It was just a kind of a cultural event. But it does really happen that some years are more eventful than others, and sometimes events cluster. I mean, it's just purely randomly that if you have a continuum of time, there's going to be some years that are going to be more eventful than others, just because sometimes events cluster in one place or another. But what happened in the summer of 1927 was there really, really was a huge and very significant clustering of events, totally randomly. I mean, Charles Lindbergh didn't fly the ocean because Babe Ruth hit 60 home runs, or, you know, because Sacco and Vanzetti were executed in Massachusetts or anything. These things were all happening independently of each other, but it was striking how so many of them all happened at the same time. And almost entirely everything that happened of significance that happened in the world that year happened in the United States between May and September.
Well, one of the things I really found interesting about the writing style, and you've employed this device too, but I always think of the great science writer James Burke and Connections, the old television series, in which he would tell you a story, then he would tell you another story out of one small fact of the first story, and then he would go and it would go and it would go and it would go from one story to another story, and then eventually you get back to your beginning story. That's sort of what you do in many of these chapters, which are centered around four big events: Lindbergh, Babe Ruth, Calvin Coolidge, the president, and the anarchist, which includes Sacco Vanzetti and many others that were at work. And was that a true device that you were trying to use?
Well, I mean, I was making the most of it whenever I came across it, because it just helped to tie all these loose threads together. I mean, at one point, it was kind of a nightmare doing this book, because at one point I had about 18 or 20 stories on the go. I mean, there was all of these things, you know, all these stories that I'd begun, and you have to keep them going along. I was moving through the summer more or less chronologically as much as I could. So, you know, I would talk about Charles Lindbergh for a while, and then I'd drop him for a bit and go on to Babe Ruth or Calvin Coolidge or some of the other people you mentioned. And at one point, you know, by getting towards the end of the summer, you've introduced a lot of stories, and you still have to keep them going. So one of the things that was always interesting to me was when there was any kind of, you know, anything that drew them together. And again, I mean, it's a random thing, but just by chance, for instance, just very shortly before Sacco and Vanzetti were executed in Boston, Lindbergh went through the city, and it is recorded that, you know, they, in the, from their prison cell, they could hear the cheering outside. And so, you know, it would be, you could say it's a kind of a device, but it's actually true as well that these things did sometimes interlink in one way or another.
One of the nice masterly bits of writing was when you're talking about Lindbergh and you're talking about the effort to fly across, to make the transatlantic flight, and especially the transatlantic flight from New York to Paris, because that would claim a prize at that particular point. And you're talking about the various efforts, and there are some very high-profile efforts. You have this sentence where you said, but nobody was really writing about Lindbergh, and what were they writing about instead? And then you tell us this wonderful story of this crazy murder case that sort of captured the country at that particular time. It was one of those crimes of the century, and it was the Snyder case, which became the fodder for a number of detective stories, but two by James Cain, Double Indemnity and The Postman Always Rings Twice.
Yeah, it was an amazing thing, because it was a really very mundane, not very imaginative murder. It was the Snyder-Gray case, as it was called, and it was really, this woman, Ruth Snyder, had an affair with somebody, and they decided between them to kill her husband and try and collect the insurance, and they had the poor husband signed a double indemnity policy, which was pay off double in the event of a violent death. And then they concocted a violent death for him. But they were completely inept and incompetent and not particularly attractive, not smart, not really interesting. And yet somehow this particular case just absolutely galvanized the nation. Part of the reason for that was because there was this, in this period, there was the rise of popular radio. So information was spread around a lot faster than it had been before. And also the rise of magazines that popularized the news, again, globally, sometimes salaciously, but also some magazines like Time magazine was brand new then. And so suddenly there were lots and lots of different media that could promote these events. And it has to be said, the newspapers back then, even the dear old New York Times, tended to be a bit more sensationalist. And they did tend to kind of inflate the importance of these things. But the upshot is that this case that really was a pretty trivial murder case became hugely influential.
And I always love the fact that the perpetrators actually took a lot of care to establish alibis, but, you know, he would stay in a hotel in Rochester the night of the crime, but he took his train ticket that he went back to New York to kill the guy. He left it in the trash basket.
Yeah, the when the police went to, you know, interview it, they just looked in the wastebasket, and there was this, you know, used train ticket that showed that he'd obviously not been in Rochester when he said he was. So yeah, they were just kind of wonderfully inept, and there wasn't any, you know, there was never any question that they were guilty and they were going to be executed for it. But if you read the newspapers from the time, it's as if it's just, this is like the biggest thing that's ever happened. It's quite, you know, sometimes, there was sometimes when doing this book where it seemed as if what I was reading about was only yesterday or, you know, not that long back. It was a pretty familiar world. Just following the baseball season, it was all seemed pretty familiar, you know. But then there are other times when it suddenly seemed very remote and strange and not like the world we live in at all.
Right. From there, you go back to Lindbergh and his preparations, but there's bad weather on the East Coast, which is keeping him grounded. And from there, you tell us the story of the Great Mississippi Flood, because this was a flood of monumental proportion. I've always read about the Great Mississippi Flood and how it affected Louisiana, where all the water eventually went.
Yeah.
But this was the whole of the Midwest. It's like something like 6 to 9 inches fell over, on average, over the entire watershed of the Mississippi.
Yeah, well, the winter of 1926-27 was unusually wet. I mean, it was just one of those years with a lot of rain all over North America. And, of course, the Mississippi River, you know, it drains most of the United States. I think it's 40% of the whole of America drains into the Mississippi. And so all of this additional rain in the spring of 1927 was falling on land that was already saturated and just couldn't hold anymore. And so it just all came roaring down. And in a volume that really has never been seen before or since, but with the additional difference that we didn't, unlike, say, 1993, when the Great Mississippi Flood then, in 1927, there wasn't all the infrastructure in place in order to, you know, swing into action and save people and, you know, really build them, find an alternative accommodation for them or, you know, look after them. It was something that people were expected to do themselves or with the help of local charities. But the government, federal government, had absolutely no tradition of helping people out in a disaster. And so it became a real philosophical issue. Does the government involve itself with this kind of thing, or is this the sort of thing that, you know, that you leave to organizations like the Red Cross? And there was a lot of, you know, a lot of people couldn't agree on that. In some ways, they still can't, but certainly back then, they absolutely couldn't agree on what the best way to proceed with something like that.
But in fact, Coolidge does appoint Herbert Hoover to head up the flood relief efforts, as he had fed Europe after World War I. And it was very interesting in descriptions of them. Coolidge detested Herbert Hoover, called him Wonder Boy. And in fact, his ability to get things done, I mean, he was just absolutely this motionless engineer at his heart.
Hoover was a very strange human being, and it is genuinely a really weird thing. If he had never run for president, he would be remembered now as a great man. His downfall was actually becoming president of the United States because, you know, it coincided with the Great Depression, and that's the thing that he's always been remembered for. And rightly or wrongly, you know, he's normally blamed for the Great Depression. But everything he did before that was you know, unquestionably good. He saved a lot of lives after the First World War. He was put in charge of all the relief efforts after the First World War. He did that with great distinction. And then he came to the United States and became part of government under Calvin Coolidge. He was Commerce Secretary in 1927. And Coolidge was, you know, he was the person they put in charge when there was a crisis, when there was a catastrophe that needed some kind of supervision. And he did, you know, brilliantly well with that. But he was a very unlikable person. I mean, he really never had a friend in his life. He was very cold. He was terrible at sharing praise or just, you know, just being a kind of decent guy. Nobody seems ever to have liked him as a person. But he was actually really, really good as an organizer.
And it was hard for me to read that and contrast his approach to fixing the effects of the flood and yet his ineffectual ability to do anything about the Great Depression when he was president. Or his sort of lack of mobilizing the people to do something about the Great Depression.
Yeah, well, I suppose, I mean, to look at it generously, I suppose anybody who was president when the Great Depression came along would really have struggled. I mean, because there was, if you read what it was like in 1927 and 1928 when the economy was booming along, and people genuinely everywhere thought this was going to go on forever. You know, nobody really foresaw the Great Depression at all. They thought there'd be a kind of correction in the stock market, but nobody saw a collapse that would lead to so many millions of people being thrown out of work and losing their homes and all of that kind of stuff. And suddenly, you know, when Hoover was elected president, it was by the greatest plurality America had ever had because the economy was doing so well. And then within no time at all, there's the Great Depression, and he suddenly has this magnificent catastrophe he has to deal with. Probably it was beyond anybody. I mean, you know, somebody needed to be in a position to step back and make an assessment before they started doing anything. And Hoover was in the position of, you know, kind of trying to put Band-Aids on a hemorrhage, and it just wasn't in a position to do that.
In fact, you, as you alluded to earlier, you tell the story of four central bankers meeting in secret. It's a section dealing with Calvin Coolidge and talking about how Calvin never met a day in which he couldn't take a good nap. And you talk about the four central bankers from the chair of the New York Fed, Benjamin Strong, Montague Norman, the governor of the Bank of England, who you said was peculiarly, he was one of the most neurotic people you would ever meet, and it was sort of a peculiar head for a head of a bank in a crisis. Hjalmar Schacht from the Reichsbank and Charles Rist from the Bank de France, who basically set up the market bubble, which greatly contributed to the Great Depression. They were trying to keep the gold standard working. So they said, let's lower interest rates in the United States so people will take their gold to Europe. And all that did was like throw fuel on gasoline on a fire.
Yeah, it's exactly what happened. They agreed to reduce the interest rates in the United States, which would have the effect of making them more attractive for investors in Britain and the rest of Europe. And so money would flow to Europe, and the idea being that it would help the European economies, which were trying, you know, which were still recovering from the war. I mean, you remember from school that Germany had, you know, ridiculous hyperinflation in the 1920s. Its economy was absolutely wrecked. And so this was a well-meaning effort on the central bank governors to try and correct the world economy, but it had the effect of just inflaming the stock market. The stock market just went through the roof. It just skyrocketed, and it got out of control, essentially. And the only possible outcome, looking at it, you know, from our perspective, from the benefit of hindsight, was that it all had to come crashing down at some point, and within 2 years it did.
My guest today is Bill Bryson, author of numerous books. His most recent is One Summer, America, 1927, which is the subject of the Tulsa Reads going on for Tulsa Town Hall, as well as the Oklahoma Center for Poets and Writers. He'll be making several appearances in Tulsa next week. You're encouraged to get a copy of the book and read it as the whole community looks at this book. And he's the author of numerous books, many bestsellers, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Let's talk about some of the central figures of the book. Charles Lindbergh. Lindbergh is a very complex person today as we look back at him, but at the time, what an authentic American hero, and what an incredible flyer, perhaps the most skilled flyer. And this is one thing your book does. It does talk about the warts that show up later, but in guiding the spirit of St. Louis across the Atlantic, it was really a masterful flying job. And this man was an incredibly accomplished pilot, and his influence had a major effect on the United States.
Yeah, huge effect, which I didn't realize. I mean, I didn't appreciate this at all. Like, I think like most people, I had always assumed or thought that, you know, Charles Lindbergh just got it in his head to fly the Atlantic and did it, and as a result of that, he became famous. But actually, you know, there was a huge race on to be the first person to fly the Atlantic. Technology had moved on just enough that it was suddenly possible that an airplane could fly from New York to Paris. And to that age, it was pretty much the equivalent of when we've, you know, sent a rocket to the moon. It was a huge global challenge. And everybody expected the nations of Europe to get there first because they were the ones that had taken the lead in airplane technology, and largely as a result of First World War. And Lindbergh was just this kid from Minnesota. He looked 18 years old. I mean, he just looked really young. He was literally virginal and fresh and wholesome, nice-looking kid. But everybody thought he was crazy because he was going to fly alone in a single-engine plane across the ocean. And all the other teams had multi-pilot planes with, you know, everybody else was going with a pilot, co-pilot, navigator, and very often a radio operator in multi-engine planes. So because it was just assumed that it was insane to try and fly across the ocean with one person in a single-engine plane, because obviously if the plane conks out, you're sunk.
Right.
And Lindbergh, this crazy kid from out of Minnesota, flies in while all these other people with their complicated planes are not able to get off the ground. And because he's got a simple plane, he's able to take off first, and he flies the Atlantic, and we all know that he became a hero. But because it was so improbable, the world erupted in just this pulse of joy that I don't think it's ever experienced anything quite like that. It's the kind of joy that people feel at the end of wars. This was, unlike a normal war, this is one with no losers. I mean, you know, when a war ends, half the people are on the losing side, and they're hardly exultant about it. This was something that everybody on Earth could turn to the person next to them and hug them, you know, and just a kind of sense of joy. It was that huge an event. And overnight, this kid, who was totally unprepared for it, became by far the most famous person on planet Earth.
Yeah, and utterly unprepared for that as well, as you write in the book. But I was struck by something. One of the curators at the Air and Space Museum, they're showing you the Spirit of St. Louis, and then he says, here's the Ford Tri-Motor, here's the DC-3. This all happened within a decade. And I think your question was, well, wouldn't that happen anyway? He says, well, it might have happened, but it wouldn't have happened in the United States, and it wouldn't have happened so quickly. It literally transformed American aerospace.
Completely transformed American aerospace. I mean, it absolutely did. There's just no question of it. But it also kind of transformed America's self-perception. We forget. I mean, you know, those of us who grew up in America and are alive now, we grew up in a world in which America was, you know, unquestionably the leading nation. It was the strongest, most powerful, had the strongest military, the most money, everything. You know, America is, there's just no doubt, it's the top nation on Earth. But in 1927, that wasn't exactly the case at all. America had a powerful economy. It was the richest nation among the industrial nations. But it didn't have that sense of confidence that we have now. It wasn't used to coming first at things. Most of the world's great literature and scientific developments and things like that came from Europe. The United States had never won a Nobel Prize for Literature in 1927. Mm-hmm. It had never really come first at anything. It took all... lead came from Europe all the time. And so for an American kid to fly to be the first across the ocean in an American-designed and American-built plane was a huge boost for America's self-confidence. And it really, you can make a pretty good case that that is where, you know, that was the moment when America unquestionably became the world's number one nation.
Mm. You next tell the story of Babe Ruth, which must have been a lot of fun. You're a big baseball fan, I know, and so telling that story must have been a lot of fun. But you really make some, you take us back to about 1920, and you have the Spanish flu. It's keeping people away from the baseball parks. It's all day baseball, and if people are working, they can't go see the baseball game. Baseball was in tough shape, even though we think of it sort of as this period is sort of the heyday. And Babe Ruth changed that because he could hit the home run. And that combined with the story of how the balls changed, which you also tell in the book, transformed baseball.
Transformed baseball, yeah. And Babe Ruth, he also, you know, helped to transform life in America, too, because he became really the first celebrity who was famous not just for what he did professionally, but for just being a human being, you know. And before that, people were famous. Ball players were very famous, but they were only famous on the ball field. Here suddenly was this guy who was as famous off the ball field as on. And that was a big, you know, transformation in American life, and one that, you know, we still have. I mean, no, you know.
In many ways, he was
in celebrities' private lives is as important to us nowadays as you know, knowing what they do professionally.
And he was the first celebrity that could get away with being bad, quote, bad.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people loved him. Because, I mean, Babe Ruth is just the most fascinating person, and almost impossible to understand, really. But basically, you know, my reading of him is that he was this immensely talented, big, lovable kind of lug of a guy who was genuinely a really nice human being, but he'd had just about as crummy an upbringing as you can have. I mean, he'd been rejected by his parents. He grew up in an orphanage, even though both his parents were still alive. He could have grown up at home, but they put him in an orphanage. He was sort of rejected by the world. He had poor education, no opportunities in life at all. And then suddenly, as a kid, you know, just barely 16, 17 years old, he's one of the greatest baseball players in America, and very quickly becoming one of the highest paid athletes in America. So it's this kid with you know, gargantuan appetites and no discipline, with a lot of money in his pocket. And he's, you know, and he's beloved by the world. So he was in a strange position. And, you know, most people who are in that position end up self-destructing in some way. Ruth didn't. He came close a couple of times, but he actually didn't. And in 1927, you know, he was thought to be pretty much over the hill, and from out of nowhere, he pulled this incredible summer out of his back pocket and had a season like, you know, nobody really has ever had before or since, and certainly without benefit of steroids.
Yeah, no, it's a really amazing story. This whole book, One Summer America, 1927, tells us so many different stories. It's the beginning of modern Broadway with Jerome Kern and Showboat. You tell the story of the first inklings of television. You tell the story of Calvin Coolidge, who really, in many ways, he and Herbert Hoover, who succeeded him, they were the last of the presidents that sort of predate the electronic media. These are guys that could get away. As you mentioned, Calvin Coolidge liked to take a nap every day, would leave and go to Rapid City, South Dakota for a month or two, and nobody would even miss him.
I really liked Calvin Coolidge as a person in doing the book. Sort of against my better instincts, because I mean, I do think that in a lot of ways he was a pretty regrettable president. And he wasn't a particularly, you know, endearing, warm, and lovable human being by any means. But I do think he was, you know, he was honest. He was sincere in what he did. He didn't work very hard because he really, really believed that the best kind of president is one who doesn't get in the way. Just that, you know, creates the circumstances which business can thrive and don't get in the way of that. And so philosophically, he didn't want to become, to intervene very much. But it also suited his temperament as well. And so in some ways he seemed just kind of, you know, you think, you should really be doing something about the Mississippi flood, Calvin. You know, there's a lot of people suffering out there, and you're not doing anything except sitting in your office in Washington and dozing. But at other times, I really found him quite endearing.
You know, there was one line in the book that just really struck me, and it had to do with the great Mississippi flood of 1927, in which You give us a sense of the awesome statistics of how much water was covering the heartland of America. And it was like there was a giant Great Lake in the southern part of the United States.
In the period of several weeks, it was really as if we had an additional Great Lake. I don't remember exact scale of it, but it was an area the size of Scotland was underwater in the middle of the United States. Yeah. And, I mean, this was hugely disruptive, not just to the people who lived there, but also just to the whole of the American economy and to the whole middle section of the country. It was a huge event. It's still the biggest natural disaster America's ever had in terms of, economic cost and that kind of thing, the extent and duration of it. And we've never had anything else to compare with it.
Well, it's a really wonderful book. One Summer, America, 1927. It's the subject of Tulsa Reads. Bill Bryson, we look forward to your appearances here in town, and thanks very much for joining us.
I can't wait to be there. Thank you very much for having me, Rich.
Writer Bill Bryson speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His most recent book, One Summer, America, 1927, is the subject of the Tulsa Reads community-wide reading initiative. You'll have two opportunities to see him next week, Friday morning at Tulsa Town Hall, which is available by subscription only, and Thursday evening at the Keynes Ballroom as the Oklahoma Center for Poets and Writers present An Evening with Bill Bryson. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.